Johnny got a toy golf set when he was three, and from that day on, he was hooked. All he wanted to do was golf, golf, golf. He'd be on the links before school, after school. All he ever wanted was to go pro. And then, one day, when he was holding his grandson and thinking about his 12 handicap, Johnny realized it just might not happen for him. But you know what did happen for him? He switched to Geico and saved a bunch of money on car insurance. So that was good, and so was hanging out with his grandson.
Geico presents, yikes, another voicemail from your roommate.
Sup, roomie? Hey, a pipe burst in the basement. It's completely flooded. Anyway, I called for someone to fix it, but in the meantime, I was thinking we could finally have that indoor pool party we've always wanted. I got some cool swan floaty things already going. Could you pick up some chips on your way home? Later.
The Geico Insurance Agency could help keep your personal property protected, like if your roommate isn't the brightest pool float in the flooded basement. Visit Geico.com to see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.
Hey everybody, this is Philip J. Fry from Futurama, pizza delivery boy. And right now you're listening to This Week in Geek, and you can find it on the web at thisweekingeek.net. Birdman and Double D. It's awesome. It's cool.
Did you grow up with the NES, PlayStation, Star Wars, cartoons, and 80s TV? Do you like to think who would win in a fight between Batman and the Master Chief? Comics, games, movies, music, and TV. They're gonna tell you everything you need. Superheroes or not, they got your back. They're gonna save the world of geeks. Comics, games, movies, music, and TV. They're gonna tell you everything you need. Superheroes or not, they got your back.
Guys, what's going on? This is Mike the Birdman Dodd, and you are listening to This Week in Geek. But I'm joined on this epic quest, as I always call every interview epic. But I'm joined with one of my best friends, co-host, and all-around man of awesome,
David Double D Dennis.
And today we have a very special show today. I was actually talking to one of our mutual friends of Twig, Maurice LaMarche, recently, and I understood he worked with another guy who's an icon in the industry. And with the recent announcement of Futurama getting recording a bunch of new episodes for shows to air in 2010, I decided, you know what, it's probably about that time. We should probably talk to this guy. And who am I talking about? I'm talking about the guy who now does the voice for basically everybody on Futurama, but he's also done Bugs Bunny, he's done Stimpy from Ren and Stimpy, and countless other video game roles, and the guy even has his own band. Who am I talking about, Dave?
Billy West.
That's so awesome. So we welcome Billy West to This Week in Geek. Billy, how are you doing this morning?
Good, what a long drum roll.
Yeah, I know. I just had to hype you up, man, make you sound uber awesome, because this is such a treat for us. Just looking back over your filmography, seeing all the voices that you've done, and just it's astounding just to see the body of work that you have behind you. So I definitely want to thank you for being on This Week in Geek.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right there. So I guess let's start at the beginning of the beginning. So, Billy, how did you get into basically Hollywood and Hollyweird and the whole voice acting gig thereof?
Let's see. When I was growing up, I used to do, I used to make noises and voices, and it was always greeted with, can you not do that kind of thing. So I always felt stifled, bridled. And so that stuff kept on when I was in school and all that. But, I kind of kept pretty much to myself. But I was learning how to play music and taught myself how to play. And I had my first band in 1966. And, just playing a lot of cool stuff and having fun. It was nothing like it after school, And a little later on, we'd play like dances, and then I started playing in town in Boston where I grew up, and the bands changed, and I was in a bunch of them, but none of them ever really went anywhere. And then, what happened here? I was getting like I was kind of going nowhere, and I was also very addicted to cocaine, and I was a big drinker. I was heavy into alcohol. It was all part and parcel to that whole music world. I know that's such a flimsy excuse, but it's just something that I fell into, never intended to, and spent a long time like that. But along the way, I kind of bowed out of music, and I fell into radio pretty much. You know, I got into radio in 1980 in Boston on an FM radio station, WBCN, which now went out of business, closed its doors after like 40 years. And, you know, I got a chance to run wild there doing characters and voices. To me, that was, seemed to be the natural place to go. You know, there weren't anybody doing, there wasn't anybody doing voices, at the station, so... You know, I got to do everything, including we didn't have any female actresses or nothing, so I tried to do everything. And it was a good place to learn, and to it was like boot camp, you know, and it was always real quick. Everything, everybody wanted everything yesterday, so I was always running around, but I guess it was good. But I started hearing the New York commercials that used to come in and listen to all this big-time stuff, and I go, I could do way better than that. So I was empowered enough to finally just get up and move to New York City, and I went to our sister station in New York, which was WXRK. It was the station that Howard Stern was on, and I got to know him a little bit, and then when I was working there, I kind of like quit working in production, which is what I did in radio, and started working just with the Stern Show 3 days a week. But it was at that time that I had been auditioning for stuff for Nickelodeon and bagged a couple of gigs. You know, I was doing commercials, like, you know, McDonald's commercials and all that stuff. And, you know, it just turned out where Nickelodeon would wind up giving me two gigs on their Saturday morning lineup. I think it was 1991. And one was Ren and Stimpy, and the other one was Doug. And that's kind of where things started going, you know, and the Stern Show was really, really popular. You know, so it was a great place to generate an electronic business card. So when I left and I moved to Los Angeles, everybody kind of knew who I was already. I mean, as far as the industry goes, and all the other voice people, you know, it was almost like I already knew them and they already knew me, because you come to admire each other through the work. And that's kind of, you know, what happened. And, you know, I kept working pretty much daily on different cartoon shows and commercials. And I've been really lucky, you know, because, I mean, for the chance to express myself as much as I do and you know, get to work. I mean, to me, it's... There's nothing like just going out and being in a room full of people like, oh, God, you know, like you mentioned Maurice and Rob Paulson, and Jim Cummings, Tress McNeil. And, you know, I've come to know the people on Futurama really well. John DiMaggio, who does a lot of cartoon stuff now. I remember when I first met him, he was like, he didn't know what hit him. You know, one day we're sitting in a limousine, you know, because we're going to a Futurama premiere, and Fox was treating us like gold, and... he's looking around, and I'm going, John, take it all in. Take it all in as quick, you know, and process it, because it goes away as fast as it comes. You know, because I had already been through the whole Ren and Stimpy thing, where suddenly you're like this cultural cult, I guess, icon. And, you know, and then as mysteriously as it appeared in your life, it mysteriously ends one day.
Now, going back to the Howard Stern Show, mm-hmm. What was it like working with the big man, as it were, and do you have any interesting stories from on the set?
I found Howard to be really refreshing, because I was rebellious still. You know, like, I was always willing to risk biting the hand that fed me, you know, for the sake of ripping it up and trying to create something new, instead of doing, you know, these tame, anemic little radio skits. You know, I mean, compared to New York, what I had done in Boston was pretty safe, you know, even though people thought that I was being crazy then. But this was all different because here was a guy that was taking chances. I mean, big time. He was willing to be fired to do the kind of radio he wanted to do. And nobody was like that. There was nobody anywhere. There were little people that were trying to be upstarts and stuff, but he was the guy. And, you know, as usual, it's like it's always the scout that takes the arrows. Like, you know, the first guy to go to Acapulco didn't have a good time. You know what I mean? He had to clear bramble and fight off wild mosquitoes and disease and animals and everything. And then hundreds of years later, everybody's sitting around, you know, looking at the beautiful ocean, having daiquiris. And the scout is the one who takes the arrows. So he took the arrows with the FCC and then suddenly made it safe for everybody else that was aspiring to be him to go out and just do their version of his show. And suddenly there were female Howards and sports Howards and, you know what I'm saying. And when I was on the Stern show, it was like sitting in the cockpit of a plane that had a nuclear bomb on it. You knew you could... You knew you could just drop it on anybody and devastate them because nobody had any way of fighting back, you know. And, you know, we picked targets, you know, usually celebrities. You know, I'm not crazy about celebrities. It doesn't really mean anything to me. It never did. You know, it's like the whole thing in the cartoon business of casting celebrities. And it's like, you know I always sound like some... you know, curmudgeon or some old, you know, malcontent. But to me, there's a difference between being an artist and a celebrity. And all the people I know are artists or artisans, and they create voices for animation. And they don't just show up and sit down and talk like they talked, you know, in every interview or whatever. And it doesn't bring a lot to the table, so if these people didn't have a big name, it might as well be my plumber doing the voice. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now...
I mean, it doesn't matter. It's like suddenly, like if these people, if you didn't know who they were, and you probably won't in 20 years, and then you go watch these movies and you go, huh, I don't know, how come, you know, old animation with people that you didn't know but created these mind-blowing characters. You can't really say that anybody's mind-blowing because there was no alchemy. There was no change, you know, where something had to be changed from lead into gold in the process. But on the Stern show, I got to do all kinds of swipes at celebrities. And, you know, it was kind of risky. But we did a lot of rough stuff, excuse me, and people would call up threatening, you know. It was just par for the course. And some lady was yelling at me for something I did and calling me names. And I'm sitting there and I go, I don't even want to get into this. So I just yelled into the microphone, shut up. You know, like Bugs Bunny. Because if he does it, it sort of takes it away from the fact that I'm doing it. You know, sort of hide behind an identity to get your point across.
Now, to kind of flow with that, so working with, like, Howard Stern and being part of that show and having that particular brand of humor, what was it like to transition into a more family-friendly environment, if you will, with the show Doug, for example? Because I think it's funny to think the voice of Doug is working on Howard Stern.
Well, I mean, I had to compartmentalize like crazy. I mean, when I was doing Ren and Stimpy, that was psychotic stuff, and I was doing the Stern show, and then at the very same time, I'd take a walk across town, and I'd be doing a very sweet 11-and-a-half-year-old character, you know, named Doug, and then the next day, I'd be back to doing the devil's work on the Stern show.
Now, did you ever just... when you were on air with Stern, did you ever get a chance to play with any of the established voices that like you've done to have a little bit of fun with it? Like, for example, having Doug tell somebody off or something like that?
Oh, no, nothing like that. I didn't want to, I didn't want to take somebody else's copywritten character, or, you know, as a rule, I didn't want to take somebody's copywritten character as far as, like, voice characters go and run amok with it. I only did it a couple of times, but it was with Warner Brothers characters. And then I wound up being the voice of Bugs Bunny. But, no, I never did stuff like that. What I did was I would create characters. And that's kind of how I could, you know, blow off steam or make a point or you know, some sort of statement in character or as a performance. But, no, some things I couldn't mix, you know what I mean? It was like, it just wouldn't be right, you know, because what was happening is I was getting all these different sections of people that knew me, you know, that didn't know me from one thing but knew me from something else. And, you know, as time went on, these people got older and they put it together that I was the guy doing this and then this over here and... you know, and I mean, that was a way of life. I mean, just running from place to place, being different things. But that's, you know, that's really what the job is about.
Now, you mentioned there that you redid some of the Looney Tunes voices for things like Space Jam and some of the other incarnations of the Looney Tunes. What was it like redoing an established character like that? And how did you stay true to the original form? And I guess second part of the question is, if you could meet Mel Blanc today, what would you ask him?
Well, I did wind up doing Bugs Bunny for like 10 years after I did Space Jam. And some other characters. I had done Elmer Fudd, which I'm doing for a new Looney Tunes project. But I'm not doing Bugs or Daffy or any of those characters. It's like there's three guys that kind of, you know, rotate between doing, you know, Bugs and some of the other characters. But let's see. I'm trying to think of the rest of the question there.
Just wondering, like, how you replicated those characters.
Oh, right. Well, I was doing them, you know, and I had auditioned against hundreds of people, which is usually the case. And you're being directed a certain way, and then, you know, people are very jaundiced. People that are not in the creative process think they can just stick their head in the door and add their two cents, but the thing is those are people that aren't artists, so they're looking for what's wrong with something rather than what's right with it. And somebody would poke their head and go, "He's too Brooklyn," or some lady would come in and go, "He's too Jewish," you know, and... it was like your head would be spinning, and I just had to do what I thought was pure. And actually, your job is to do what the director wants from you. So, I mean, it's not just a singular effort. It's a concerted effort between director, animator, and talent. So, you know, I mean, I just had to go with what I wanted. It was supposed to be a big order to fill those shoes. If I saw Mel Blanc today, I'd say, "Hey, remember in 1980 when I met you at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts?"
Geico presents yet another voicemail from your roommate.
Hi! So, about the kitchen. Turns out, when there's a grease fire, you're not supposed to throw water on it. Who would have known, right? Anyways, the fire department is here, and it's totally cool. Give me a call back when you get a chance.
The Geico Insurance Agency could help keep your personal property protected. Like if danger is your roommate's middle name. Visit geico.com to see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.
You shouldn't go to Barnes & Noble and buy 10,000 books just so you can build a book fortress and yell out, "I am your book leader." You shouldn't buy 147 copies of War and Peace, stuff them inside turkeys, and serve them at Thanksgiving as turbookins. And you definitely shouldn't buy up all the copies of Dork Diaries, causing the neighborhood kids to stage a protest in your front yard. But you could, because at the Barnes & Noble Book Haul, you can get over 1,000 titles for 50% off. Stock up at your local Barnes & Noble. Turbookins are fictitious and should not be cooked at home.
You know, because I had met him back in the 80s, early 80s, and shook hands with him. It was almost like that painting, you know, The Creation, where man is holding his hand up in the air, sticking his finger up, and then there's God, you know, like extending his arm downward and That's what it was like when I met him.
Oh, wow. So now that you've got this and, like, you've done the Bugs Bunny character and all of the other Looney Tunes characters, what has been your proudest moment of doing all these characters and thinking, you know, I think Mel would appreciate this?
I think Mel lived in a world of his own. I mean, he was head and shoulders above his peers, and they all sort of knew that and accepted that. But a lot of my heroes were people that were names that people might not have known, but to me they were titans. You know, like Don Messick and Dawes Butler and June Foray and people like that, that were part of my heroes gallery. Of course, I played guitar, so the other half of my hero gallery was musicians. And you know, and I got to meet or work with a lot of my idols. Over the years, talk about, you know, I mean, what are the odds against that? You know, I've worked with, one of my first big idols was Sid Caesar from the early days of television, because I saw that stuff. I'm really old. I am. And I saw that stuff in real time back in the 1950s, and it split my head open. It just knocked me on my ass. I couldn't believe that this man was doing all these crazy things, and it stuck with me. And then Jonathan Winters became, you know, a big deal to me in the 60s, and I actually got to work with both of them on the same project. And I worked with June Foray, you know, who was Granny in Sylvester and Tweety, and she was on Rocky and Bullwinkle, played tons and tons of characters. Natasha, and then these little fairy princesses and these old fishmonger wives and hags. She was great. She still is. I just absolutely love her. But, I mean, June Foray would be hitting herself in the head with a hammer if she finds out, like, what Cameron Diaz makes for walking in the studio and being Cameron Diaz in a cartoon. You know, I mean, I always pull that example out because it's horrifying. It's, like, terrifying to hear what they make. And they're always saying, like, no, I do it for my kids. You know, and meanwhile, it's like $20 million for 2 weeks worth of work.
That's insane.
It is insane. But, since animation is becoming really popular, it's almost like those are the only movies making any money. And God forbid, you know, that we lose our star system. So they're sticking them in all the cartoons.
Now, do you think this is
like
something that's going to change?
The movies that are made, the more disappearance of a lot of, celebrities that are in movies usually, so they're sticking them in all the animation movies.
Yeah, I've got to say, having a lot of stars in animation, I really think is taking away from actors like yourself. And a really good example, I think, in my mind, I was at the theater.
It doesn't take anything away from me. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm very busy, and I'm super grateful, and I have nothing but gratitude. But I feel bad for people like guys that write me letters and women that get in touch with me, you know, wanting to go into the business. What am I going to do? Tell them, okay, first you got to be on a sitcom, and then you got to win some Emmys, and then you got to be in the movies, and then you got to become really popular. You know, I mean, the odds are 1,000,000,000 to 1 against that. But if you have talent and you walked into a business that welcomed you with open arms, you know, it's still a bit of a crapshoot, but at least you have a chance based on your abilities. But now the game is so strange. But, I mean, it doesn't take anything away from me. You know, people are always like, when I say this stuff, it's like, oh, what? No, you know, everything isn't enough for this guy. He does everything. No, I'm talking about people that had dreams of doing what me and my peers, my friends, do. And I don't know what to tell them. I said, listen, with the marriage of the internet and television, there'll be a lot going on that celebrities won't even bother with. You know, I remember when they refused to do voices for television cartoons. You know, movie stars don't bother with that. And, you know, a lot of TV stars didn't want to do it until they got really, really old. And you'd see these guys that were like, you know, world known, sitting next to you, you know, 80 years old, looking at the rest of us and going, I don't belong here. He says, I don't know where you people come from. You're like from another planet, because to the left of the guy is somebody who can do 100 different voices for a character that they're just trying to figure out how he should sound. And then the women are the same way. It's like, you know, because they're real artists. They create characters. And, you know, I just feel bad for people that want to get into the business. But I'm always nothing but encouraging, saying, you know, just if it's in you, you have to do it. It takes you. It chooses you. You don't choose it. It grabs you and takes you wherever you need to go.
Now to kind of follow up with like what I was saying previously with that, like how you have some of these people that are retired and now doing voices, is there anybody you feel currently who is a big movie star and is doing a fairly decent job of doing the animation work to make it their own, maybe?
Well, to me, it's the people that understand what multiple characters really are, physically and vocally, and that would be Robin Williams, Eddie Murphy, Mike Myers. They know what it's like to physically change your voice so you don't sound like you. Eddie Murphy to a lesser extent, but they've got him doing all this jive, you know. But the thing is, he understands how characters work and not, you know, going in there and giving it some read and trying to be animated. And you know, I've watched a lot of them act on the microphone, and their arms are flailing around, and they bump the mic, and I don't know, you know.
Now, moving along into
it is
a different,
what it is.
Into it is what kind it is. Of a different vein. I guess I should move to kind of the big dark horse in the room, which of course is Futurama. How did you land that role? How did you meet Matt Groening? And I guess if you have any cool stories doing the several of the characters for that show.
Well, I was done with doing Ren and Stimpy, and I had already gone through a spate of four seasons of this and four seasons of that. I mean, I was doing Woody Woodpecker and a bunch of other shows at the same time, and you know, keeping really busy. And then in 1999, I think the casting call went out for Futurama, and I knew it was Matt's, you know, new project, new baby. And I said, God, I would love to work with that guy, you know, because I'm like zillions of other people. I just like his whole thing, the psyche, the ideologies behind you know, the characters that he created. And so I went to audition, and this room was filled with people. You know, I mean, I walk in and I see Ryan Stiles sitting there, and I'm going like, okay, goodbye, you know. I was intimidated, and but the thing was is it was a cartoon, and these guys really understand cartoons and how you create voices for them. And I looked at the pictures of the characters that they wanted me to audition for, and I was like struck by lightning. I don't know. It's like one, you know, some days, you know, it's like a guitar player, you know, and he's making recordings. And some day you hit a beautiful, badass note, and then another day you don't. But that was my badass note day. No, it's just I looked at these characters and I sailed right into as much as I could bring to the table. Now, there's a difference between doing impressions and creating characters. Like on the Stern Show, when I used to do characters, you know, people would refer to it when I would do like this. My buddy, Jackie Martling, the writer, he, you know, there was this puppet of him, and it was very Twilight Zone because I would haunt him with his own image and do this highly distorted, grotesque version of what he sounds like. And people loved it, but then they'd run around going, when Billy does his, you know, Jackie puppet impression. And the thing was, it's not an impression if I created it. It's an impression if you do it. You know, I mean, there's like a big difference between doing impressions and creating something. And so, you know, with Futurama, I really tried for that. I tried to fuse different showbiz periphery. You know, like if you fuse one character actor with another and you play with it, you know, you've got an entirely brand new character to mess with. And so, you know, they hired me to do Zoidberg, the professor, and I was not Fry originally, and Zap Brannigan hadn't been introduced yet. So I got the professor and Zoidberg. And then, as the show began to, you know, find its definition or its identity, they started bringing in more characters. But then there was this talented actress named Nicole Sullivan was doing Leela, and then the next thing I know, it was Katie Sagal doing Leela, and I found myself doing Fry. So. You know, because I was doubling up left and right with characters, and I think they just said, you know, well, hey, you know, this guy, let's give him a shot, you know. I mean, but Matt knew who I was. He says, yeah, I know your work, and I said, I kind of know who you are too.
Now, Fry is such a big part of many people's lives. I know I love the character myself. How has it changed your life doing a character that so many people know and love?
Well, do you know how I said that, you know, I'd rather create characters than do impressions? But that Fry character is the closest to my voice, or at least the way it was when I was 25, than you can imagine. And it's the first time I ever did that because I thought, well, the other ones are so... You know, they're rooted in reality, but they have, like, caricature-type voices. They're over the top, and they're big. And you know, mimics can grab a hold of those and do them, and I thought, you know, it makes you replaceable if you kick your heels up over something. And I said, but you know what? It's real hard to imitate somebody's just natural voice. You know, if they don't have any distinguishing characteristics, which I believe I don't really, I have a plain vanilla kind of voice, but, you know, 25 years old, I was like that same way. It's like, oh man, I broke a guitar string. What am I going to do now? You know, that kind of stuff. Man, all this constant exposure to radiation is making me thirsty.
So with, like, doing the character of Fry and all these other characters on Futurama, I mean, have, like, you ever sat back and looked, I guess, into the minds of these characters and what they must be thinking as they go through their adventures? I guess if you've ever looked deeper into the philosophy of it. If you have to go off on a bit of a kind of tangent here, like when you go into the booth with these characters, do you ever take the minds of what they must be thinking with you?
The characters?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, because there's a lot of things that become apparent to you as you read stuff. It's like on Seinfeld, they were first a room full of characters when you first saw them. And then the more you watched episodically... And the more you paid attention, you began to realize that these are four psychotics. You know what I mean?
Oh, they're yeah.
Like, they're like psychotic. Definitely neurotic. And so the thing is I began to look at Futurama, and every one of them has this sort of really dark side that pops up in humor. You know, it's like, oh, well, somebody got blown away, and then they make a joke about it, and then they go back to being... You know, the clearly defined character who they are, but there's a lot of dark stuff there, and I thought, well, yeah, it gives an inner life to the characters. I never wanted to do a throwaway voice or characterization for any character, even if they'd had two lines. I really tried, you know, to bring them to three dimensions.
Now, are you looking forward to the new 2010 season of Futurama, and what was it like reprising that role over so much of a gap from when it was originally canceled?
Well, we did those movies, and, you know, it was like being back in the saddle. And then, excuse me, after the movies, the TV show was announced, and we've already done like six episodes. You know, we've already recorded like six episodes. And it's just like you never forget. You never forget the groove because it's the same people. I just feel so damn lucky every time I go in there. You know, because to me that's the favorite show that I've ever done is Futurama. You know, on every level. Very satisfying to be involved with. And, yeah, it's almost like a dream playground for somebody like me where I get to do all these different characters.
I guess sort of to wrap things up a little bit here, I guess we'll have a few more questions. Do you have any interesting stories from on the set, just being a, or in the booth, I guess, being a voice actor?
Yes, there's a great story about how when we were first recording the show, John and I had never worked together before, and I have this habit of sitting there looking really innocent and then just casually tossing off a remark that could knock you on your ass. You know, like super dirty or whatever, you know what I mean, or outrageous, but it was to keep things jumping, you know, because we riff. We go back and forth all the time when we're not actually recording the lines, and that contributes to the, I don't know, to the life force of things is when we're sitting there riffing, it gets you going, and then when you go to do your lines, you come into it from a different trajectory, like barnstorming, bringing a lot of energy to it. And John would just die laughing at a lot of stuff that I was saying, and I realized I had an audience, so I would deliberately keep saying little stuff, and then he'd laugh his ass off at something, and then it would come back to him a little later, like while I was recording a line, and I'd hear this, he'd break out in laughter. And it got to be so bad that they had to send him away. And he had to go, he went to the corner of the room first. This was the first remedy, so that he wouldn't ruin takes. It was, he took the giant couch pillow, you know, like one of the cushions from the couch, and buried his face in it and hid in the corner. And you could still hear this chortling underneath the pillow. And he'd come up all red-faced and go, oh, I better go. You know, it was just one of those things I never forgot. I said, this is just priceless, man. I wish there was somebody filming all this.
So I guess, Billy, as my final question to you, and to get a little bit serious for a moment, I'm reading here on your Wikipedia article that you were diagnosed with like prostate cancer and chronic depression and whatnot. How has that affected you as a performer, and what do you hope that your performances give to those that may be going through similar things? Because like you just described, you gave laughter to John there so much that he had to leave. I mean, like, but did you ever...
I realized that it was more than being like a class buffoon, that laughter is what it is. It's like love is love and laughter is laughter, and there's many forms and many levels. Being diagnosed with cancer, you know, I wasn't like, you know, because I'm the healthiest person you'll ever meet. I mean, I'm a total vegan. I eat raw food. You know, I exercise. I don't do any drugs. I don't drink. You know, I'm like little Johnny Jones, the boy next door now. But the thing about making people laugh, it was my wife that had tried to tell me how valuable it was, because I was miserable when I came home from work all the time. I didn't even know I was depressed, and I had no idea, and I couldn't celebrate along with everybody else these great things that were going on. But she said, don't you see what you're giving these people that feel sometimes like there's no way out, and that they're boxed in and they don't have any money, or there's you know, something going on to keep them miserable. What you do for them is you give them an escape. And I didn't realize it until I was diagnosed with cancer. I had been treated for depression, so I was feeling better, but none of this stuff ever affected my work. I never brought it to the workplace. I never told anybody, you know, how I felt. I just appeared like this, you know, overcharged, over-energized, you know, neurotic and all that, but I never told anybody I had cancer until I had been operated on and it was gone. but it never affected any performance ever because that was my escape. You know, that was the way that I was being treated for depression, is that I was so damn lucky enough to be able to go to a place that would make me forget all the other shit that was bothering me and just immerse myself in these fantastic worlds, you know, and then I'd have to go home and deal with my real feelings. But it never affected the work, though. I think it was a combination of just, you know, my dedication to it, my love of it, you know, far and away above everything else. But, you know, that's about the size of it. And then, you know, I had a surgery and I was, you know, I was all cleaned out, and as they say. And, you know, by knock wood, everything's, you know, so far so good.
Wow, that's pretty intense stuff. So I guess I'll ask you one more question and then we'll get to wrapping things up here. Looking back on your entire career, what would you say is your biggest achievement as well as your biggest regret?
I guess my biggest regret was that I wasted so much time drinking and drugging when I was playing in bands, but, you know, that's a regret. The regret that I, you know, I didn't even know I had, like, this horrible, horrible depression until I was, like, 50 years old. You know, and I'm diagnosed with this, and I had no idea that I never spent my life on a level playing field as everyone else. I thought everybody felt the way I did, and that I was a pussy, and I couldn't deal with life on life's terms, you know, like all these other people. But I realized that life shouldn't have been that way, so it was a rough thing to overcome. But you know, at least finding out at 50 is better than never finding out, you know, so I can A-B, like what it's like to wake up happy in the morning instead of the fear of death, you know, that you can't even leave the shower. You know, that it's regrettable, but that it just had to happen, and the whole drinking and drugging had to happen. You know, our lives are the sum total of the way we conducted them. So, you know, I wouldn't be here sitting right here talking to you if things hadn't gone the way they went. So that's the way I look at it. But as far as the upsides, I guess it's making people laugh. People enjoying stuff is the greatest thing that you could do for someone is to watch somebody watching stuff that we do and that they're dying laughing. I mean, to me, that makes everything worth it. Like, I didn't get in this business to be famous or be a celebrity. I don't really like celebrity anything. Or make a ton of money. I did it because they had to do it. I had no choice. Like I said earlier, it chose me. And it grabbed me by the shoulder and said, here's where you're going. You know, it doesn't matter what you want to do. So that's kind of how everything worked out. But yeah, the early stuff, you know, it's regrettable, but it had to be. And I'm very lucky. So, you know, it kind of cancels it out that I've had, like, you know, a pretty decent back end in life. You know, doing what you love for a living. I mean, remember Al Lewis from the Munsters, Grandpa?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Al Lewis, yeah. Munsters. I had dinner with him a bunch of times because I knew him, and I said, what's the secret of life, Grandpa? Because the guy was like over 90 years old at that point. I said, what's the secret of life? And he just looked at me grinning from ear to ear, with a twinkle in his eye, and he says, you got to do what you love and love what you do. And he was right. You know, I mean, I can't think of a better way to spend life.
Wow, that's really cool, just to get the secret of life from Grandpa Munster.
I know. Talk about the showbiz time-space continuum.
I mean, I guess that's like getting emotional advice from, like, Leonard Nimoy, you know, like Spock telling you how to feel. That's just mind-blowing, because...
It is, because the characters that you know are surreal, and when the guy who really did them is sitting down, you know, just being frank with you, yeah, it's crazy. It's insane, but it's beautiful, you know?
Absolutely. So, Billy, I want to thank you for taking the time for being on This Week in Geek. We want you to hold the line for just a moment afterwards. But it's so great just to hear about all the things that you've done, the people that you've met, and just to see how you've really made your life just be your own. And especially for me and Dave being in radio, hearing your experiences with Howard Stern, that's very encouraging, because that's what we're trying to do, is just be who we want to be in this industry and not be stifled by any stuffed shirts. And
well, yeah,
just thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, I have every reason in the world to feel good and be happy, and, you know, I wish the same for everybody else.
Well, I definitely got to say I got some inspiration today. So, Dave, why don't we wrap things up here? So, I guess that was our interview with Billy West, a fantastic voice, had a fantastic career this guy's had. And I was really surprised just to hear about some of the really more in-depth things, just to really get into his head, so to speak.
Yeah, it was inspirational for me, not just as an aspiring radio voice / voice actor, but also as a person. Just knowing kind of the effect that laughter can have on people is very inspirational.
Absolutely. I mean, like, that's one of the things, I know you and I have had conversations with that before, how I say that that's one of the greatest gifts I think you have, is you have the ability to make people laugh. You make us laugh every week with your rants, being Sam Jackson shooting dinosaurs to Batman losing his car keys. So it's a very strange world that you have. So anyway, guys, that's pretty much going to do us here on This Week in Geek. So we'll be coming back next week with a brand new episode. I think next week's topic, it'll either be Call of Cthulhu or maybe something to do with Neon Genesis Evangelion. We're not quite sure yet. So anyway, guys, be sure to keep it locked here right here on thisweekingeek.net. But if you're also interested, you can hear me on 1150 AM WIMA on the Mike Miller Morning Show. And most recently, my newest radio gig on 104.9 FM CHWC on the beach with Kevin and Kate, where I'll be talking about the latest in video games. So, Dave, any parting words for the crowd?
Keep laughing, keep having fun, and have a nice day, I guess.
All right. And as I'm often fond of saying when I sign off, guys, live free or die hard, and we'll be back next week right here on This Week in Geek on thisweekingeek.net.
Want to see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
What the hell happened to George Lucas?
Remember, kids, buy pizza, pay with snakes.
What's your social media business card? My fist.
Just give me a big box of beef.
Don't give them ideas.
Don't forget our other twig project, GeorgeLucasHasLostHisMind.com.
Does Jesus have Matrix powers?
I think the Pillsbury Doughboy's albino.
I'd like to see a cat on Tourette's.
That's the moment I give up on life. Because then I don't know what to believe in anymore. When the Amish start twittering, I'm done.
Can we leave this subject alone?
Hello.
I can feel it coming in the air tonight. Oh no.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm confused. As you can imagine, they don't let us out much.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week to hear Kyle Hebert say...
Today, the world. Tomorrow, the universe. Next week, my chiropractor. Oy, my back.
Check out our website, thisweekingeek.net, for more geek content, as well as subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment about this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can also call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202 or email us at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. This extra music was produced by perpetualemotionmachine.ca. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the...
Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, this is pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon. Yeah.
That's Hugo tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.